It's 19 hours 30 UTC on Wednesday, January 3rd, and this is Zimbabwe Today.
If we are treating thousands of people for free, where are we going to get the gloves? Where are we going to get the medication?
That was Dr. Evans Masitara with the Zimbabwe Association of Doctors for Human Rights. We'll have more on that story and others coming up.
Good evening, I'm Chidondrede.
And I'm Kutsunai Mutatwa on VOA Zimbabwe Today.
The government has told Zimbabwe's public hospitals that they must treat high-risk groups free. That includes children under the age of 5, people above the age of 65, as well as all maternity patients. Although it is not a new policy, there are concerns about the announcement. Reporter Kutsai Zinawashe has the report from Harare.
The government is demanding that hospitals enforce an old policy which many had ignored for years. Hospitals said they had to charge all patients to keep running. Dr. Evans Masitara is Secretary General for the Zimbabwe Association of Doctors for Human Rights. He welcomes the move by government.
We support this noble gesture, which will increase access to healthcare.
He does, however, have reservations.
Healthcare facilities need resources for their day-to-day operations. If we are treating thousands of people for free, where are we going to get the gloves? Where are we going to get the medication? So I think it would make more sense to have this move coupled by an increase in the budgetary allocation of health to cover that gap.
Dr. Ruth Labord is a member of parliament for Matabele North for the opposition MDC. She is the chairperson of the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee on Health and Childcare.
Maybe the government has raised money. Since we are on holiday, we don't know. And I heard the PEMSEC saying the budget has been increased. So hopefully they'll be dragged.
PEMSEC is short for Permanent Secretary. Together with cabinet ministers, they are the custodians of their respective ministries. The order to enforce the fee policy comes as President Emmerson Mnangagwa pushes ministries to meet a 100-day deadline for addressing key targets. Masitara explains the challenges that affect the health sector date decades back.
Our healthcare sector is still in the intensive care unit. If we look at the three important pillars, which are infrastructure, manpower, and resources, we find that they are lacking.
He says most public hospitals have not been updated since the colonial era in 1980. Government employees in the health sector have employment grievances and are not motivated. He adds hospitals often run out of basic drugs, a problem that has escalated with the country's cash crisis. For VOA, this is Kutsai Zinawashe from Harare.
The government's decision to have hospitals enforce the policy on free treatment for small children, the elderly, and expecting mothers is drawing a lot of attention on social media. Many people have doubts about the policy.
Kelly Ann Tavares says, how will it work, though? Who covers the cost? Will it be reliable?
Siane Mateke says, this is just a populist act. Where will they get the money to buy drugs? Healthcare cannot be free in the 21st century. The health sector will collapse further.
Lista Manjea says, good news. I hope this is going to be a great improvement in the health service. Enough medication, staff, good treatment, and saving of people's lives. We need good hospitals with new technology.
Theo says, all these negative comments are, in my opinion, very wrong. Nobody says that the current system is perfect. We all agree it is not, but let's all agree that this is a start and this is far more than we had yesterday.
Simon says, let us learn not to mix issues. What is the link between waiving payments for vulnerable groups and the inadequate supplies at the hospitals? Are we suggesting that these vulnerable groups must continue to pay for the partial health services until such a time there is adequate medical supplies?
Chamunorwa says, you can make it free, but as long as there are no supplies in the hospital for medical staff to work with or dispense, then this is just a sham free medical access.
Violence erupted yesterday afternoon at Simex Mall and culminated in the destruction of property at Harvest House, the opposition MDCT headquarters in Harare. There are differing versions of what happened, but reports of rocks and stones being thrown, as well as gunshots, have been confirmed. I spoke with several people involved in the fight and the aftermath. Samuel Wadzai is the director of the Vendors Initiative for Social and Economic Transformation, or VSET. I spoke to him earlier today about what the vendors have to say. Tell me a little bit about that.
Okay. So our preliminary investigation has indicated that it was a misunderstanding between some dealers at a space called Zimex Mall. So this was as a result of a great misunderstanding. That's the reason why there was those running battles. We are not so sure how the MDC, we are not sure how they ended up going to the offices of the MDC, but that's what happened. They ended up going to the offices of the MDC, and we are still to ascertain why they went to those offices and why there was such a destruction of property. Yes, we know that there was one person at the office of the MDC who was injured. That's the report that we got today. We also now know that there was some damage to property. I guess that's in the extent of the damage, but we know that there was some breaking at the headquarters of the Movement for Democratic Change, and some property was destroyed.
The opposition MDCT has a different perspective. I spoke with Obert Gotu, opposition MDC national spokesperson, about the group's views.
No, it's actually from the internal investigations that we carried out. It's actually done a few, because vendors are normally, you know, very well behaved, because you'd actually realize that most of our supporters really are vendors because of the problem of getting former jobs in Zimbabwe. So we and the vendors have got a very good working relationship, because invariably the majority of the vendors also happen to be our supporters. In fact, quite a good number of them actually hold positions within our various party structures. So it was actually a distinct case of ZANU-PF thugs led by one Godfrey Gomwe, who were unleashing violence at our party HQ. And I don't want to blame vendors at all. I want to completely absolve the vendors of any blame.
Okay, and then what do you say in regards to the accusation that Mr. Gomwe has put forward that MDC youths have a tendency to go into Zimex Mall and kind of vandalize the vendors?
No, that's obviously just a wild, accusation. It's baseless, totally, frivolous, completely vexatious, utterly and completely frivolous and vexatious, very untrue, very false. Because what business would our youth, our supporters, what reason would they have to walk all the way or drive all the way from, Harvest House along Nelson Mandela Avenue to Zimex Mall, which is right in the center of the city? I mean, what would they want there? So he's just, Gomez is obviously just trying to hide behind a finger. He knows that he is the chief perpetrator of the violence. He was actually the commander-in-chief of those violent ZANU-PF thugs. So he's just trying to hide behind a finger. And obviously, no serious-minded person who knows the situation on the ground here in Harare would believe him. He's just trying to absorb himself from blame. But he knows in his heart of hearts that he was actually at the center of this whole violent incident. He was actually, directing operations. He was the commander-in-chief, as I said, of the audio violence that was perpetrated at our party SQS.
The MDC says Harare ZANU-PF youth leader Godwin Gomwe was the ringleader behind the violence. VOA Zimbabwe Service reporter Jonga Kandamiri spoke with him earlier today to get his take on yesterday's events.
Vanhu vepaHarvest House
Gomwe says that according to information he has received, the events that led to the violence have been going on for a while. He says that people from Harvest House have been provoking vendors at Zimmix Mall. But Gomwe is clear about one thing. He's not to blame.
No, I was not there.
For the vendors, there remains plenty of confusion about the incidents.
Well, now we don't know how the political parties are getting into this. We are still investigating to find out if our members, the ones that caused the politics of the coming of politics, were yet to ascertain that. But we know for sure that it's affecting the policies of a movement for democratic party.
That was Samuel Wadzai talking with me earlier today.
As part of efforts to boost the economy, Zimbabwe officials say they will sell stakes in up to 8 government-owned companies, including Air Zimbabwe and the National Railways. Terence Mukube, the Deputy Minister of Finance and Economic Planning, said today the government may totally diverse from some companies. The government owns all or part of more than 90 businesses, everything from banks to telecommunications companies. Most have lost money for years, adding to Zimbabwe's budget deficit. President Emmerson Mnangagwa has pledged to cut the deficit and stabilize the slumming economy. Last year, the budget deficit topped $1.8 billion, or 11% of gross domestic product. Some of the other companies that will go on the block include power company ZESA Holdings and Agribank.
President Emmerson Mnangagwa has promised to fix Zimbabwe's ailing economy. There is much to do, from ending the cash shortage to rebuilding infrastructure to reforming scores of state-owned companies, and he's facing a deadline to show progress, the general election scheduled for later this year. Gib Sube with the VOA Zimbabwe service spoke with ZANU-PF lawmaker Joseph Tsuma and political analyst Kululuke Sibanda at Britain's Huddersfield University about the economy, a key point of dispute for the two men, the military's role in government.
So I'll start with you, Mr. Tsuma. So what is Mr. Mnangagwa and his government going to do before elections? Is he going to transform the economy?
There is definitely a very, very bright light at the end of this tunnel. It has come to a point whereby now we realize the elderly advice that was left for us by our former president, Arajin Mugabe, when he said in vernacular, he went into Nebasa, meaning that you and me have a task ahead of us. And now it is the time now to recognize that thing and then take it upon ourselves to say, what are you and me doing about the resuscitation of the economy of Zimbabwe? Because that's exactly what is required right now. What is required now is that let's be positive. Let's give people a chance and let us help. Let us play our part in Zimbabwe. The economy, when it's bad, it is bad for you and me and our families and our children and, and the next generation. So now we need to look at it again and say, what do we want to leave as a legacy, as a people?
Dr. Sibanda, do you see anything coming out of Mr. Mnangagwa's government between now and perhaps before the elections? As Mr. Tsuma is saying here, you know, he says people must be positive. But does positivity bring the results?
What Zimbabwe needs is something close to a miracle. And you're not going to have a miracle with the same people that Mugabe worked with for the past 37 years. You're not going to have a miracle by appointing a military, people who've been career military people, into major sectors of the economy and various government departments are carrying out what they call command systems. You have a serious problem with that. Those things, the people that the president has appointed into particular positions, the position is taken on legality, on the constitution, in terms of arresting people and dealing with corruption in a one-sided manner where you have people who are not supporting him being targeted. Now you hear that in rural Zimbabwe, members of the opposition party are being targeted. It is clear that the president isn't looking at things that can push the country forward, but is looking at entrenching himself. And that is the first problem.
Well, my good brother here, Mr. Sibanda, carries a notion that I suppose is viewed by many as such. But I want to demystify this thing a bit for him and the like-minded today. The military here in Zimbabwe is not just an aggression force or a troop of people that are just waiting to fight. In the military, we actually have a lot of very, very intelligent and suitably and well-qualified personnel there. You can actually find engineers, doctors, economists, marketeers, you name it, they're all there. So there's absolutely nothing wrong with military personnel coming in to the systems of government. They are still well-qualified. They are well groomed in terms of IQ and education. So don't be worried about that.
Dr. Spanda, your reaction to that?
We are in 2017, and we discovered as early as 1890 that division of labor was the greatest tool in the development of what you call industrialization. It is what has brought us to where we are today as a world. The idea that Zimbabwe is some country that lives in the 17th century, where you will have people who are jack of all trades, they are at the same time experts in the military and at the same time experts in all sectors of the economy and in all aspects of politics and all categories of life, is just not nauseating. It is dangerous. But also maybe that it must belong to people who belong to those centuries, not to this century, in a very respectful manner. No one should at this time, in this year, in this age, want to tell us or even convince us that there's such a thing as a jack of all trades. We do want masters. We need masters. Somebody who's a master in one thing and can carry forward.
You're listening to Zimbabwe Today, live from Voice of America Studio 22. I'm Chidondrede in Washington, D.C. At 46 past the hour, we continue with more news.
A suicide bomber attacked a mosque in Nigeria's northern Borno state Wednesday, killing at least 10 people. Witnesses say the attacker entered the mosque in the town of Gamboru shortly before dawn prayers and detonated his explosives, reducing the building to rubble. The attacker is among the dead, witnesses said. No one has claimed responsibility for the bombing, but it bears the hallmarks of Boko Haram, which has been engaged in a bloody 8-year insurgency aimed at establishing a strict Islamic state in northern Nigeria, leaving 20,000 people dead. Police, civilians, churches, and mosques have been among its targets.
Malawi is battling a cholera outbreak that began at the start of the rainy season in November. The disease has killed 4 people, while more than 150 others are hospitalized. Lamik Masina reports from Blantyre.
The disease, an acute diarrheal infection caused by consuming contaminated food or water, affects children and adults and can kill within hours if left untreated. The hardest hit districts are Nkatabe and Karonga on the shores of Lake Malawi. Joshua Malango is the spokesperson for the Ministry of Health.
As of today, we have almost 137 cases which have been registered for Karonga only. And unlike Karonga, Nkatabe, there are only 16 cases. As of today, we have no deaths. While in Karonga, we have had 3 deaths.
The Kasungu and Dowa districts have registered 1 case each, while on Tuesday, medical workers confirmed 2 cases in the capital, Lilongwe. The outbreak is believed to have been triggered by poor hygiene among residents, especially in Karonga. Special Absalom is a journalist based in Karonga. He told VOA that over 70% of people there use untreated water.
People who are along the lakeshore area use water directly from the river. Others who are close to the rivers are using water from the rivers, and some are even using wells.
In neighboring Zambia, the disease has killed about 40 people in the capital, Lusaka, and affected more than 1,500 others since September. But Malango says Malawians bordering Zambia should not panic over Lusaka outbreak.
We are not that close with Lusaka. But still more, we are not taking life. We are putting measures to ensure that people traveling in and out of the country, they must have proper surveillance. We have checked them to ensure that Malawians are safe.
Meanwhile, Malawi's government has embarked on a nationwide campaign to remind people to wash their hands with soap, especially after using the toilet and before eating any food. More importantly, Malango says the government is distributing chlorine and other chemicals to treat drinking water. Malawi suffered its worst cholera outbreak in 2009 when 82 people died out of over 3,000 cases across the country. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
Five Kenyan police officers are dead after members of the Al-Shabaab Islamic militant group attacked their vehicle Wednesday. Officials say three police reservists and two senior officers were killed as they were traveling in the northern country of Mandera, near the border with Somalia. The Somali-based Al-Shabaab has launched a series of attacks in Kenya since 2011. The attacks are in revenge for Kenya sending troops to Somalia to drive them out of the capital, Mogadishu, as part of a team of African Union peacekeepers and Somali security forces. Al-Shabaab remains active in Somalia, trying to overthrow the government and instill a strict form of Islam. It has deployed bomb attacks against government, military, and civilian targets.
China's ban on the domestic ivory trade has come into effect after being announced at the end of 2016. Some African conservationists are calling it the best news for elephants in years. But there is a concern that the market will shift to nearby countries. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
The legal sale of ivory will no longer be able to occur in mainland China, a move heralded by conservationists, who say that the legal trade has been providing cover for its illegal counterpart, perpetuating the belief that it is okay to buy and own ivory. Max Graham, CEO of the elephant conservation group Space for Giants, welcomes the news.
I think the fact that we've seen China take this stand means that there's a new conservation superpower in the world that is taking its responsibility seriously. And, you know, we're hugely enthusiastic about this because obviously it's ivory, the ivory trade is a huge challenge, but the illegal wildlife trade more generally has many challenges in Asia, particularly China, where traditional uses of wildlife parts have been fueling the massive loss of species, of rare species around the world. So to see China take this stand is very encouraging. It's the best Christmas present that the conservation community could actually have.
China announced the ban at the end of 2016 and put it into effect at the end of 2017, surprising those who thought it might take up to 5 years. Conservationists are optimistic, although they say it is too early to predict how it will be enforced. Save the Elephant's CEO, Frank Pope, believes the ban could prove transformational for the fortunes of elephants, but gives one caveat.
As you squeeze the balloon of the Chinese trade, you're going to see secondary markets popping up around the borders. And that's what we're already seeing in Vietnam, in Laos, in Myanmar, and even in Hong Kong, which functions as external to China. All of these places have markets that have boomed with the restrictions, the looming restrictions in China.
Like his conservation colleagues, Philip Maruthi, Vice President of Species Conservation at the African Wildlife Foundation, also praises the ban and notes the importance of preventing the market from shifting to other locations. And, he says, elephants will not be the only beneficiaries.
You know, about 35,000 elephants, the number you've had quoted many times, are lost each year. There is about 415,000 elephants on this continent. That means that within 20 years, if the pace is kept of that loss, we will not have elephants. And therefore, all the aspirations that African people have for using wildlife and associated habitats for development, tourism, even countries like Kenya, South Africa, Tanzania, and all that, those aspirations will not be met. So this is big. It is not just about elephants. It's also about the economy. It's about African people's well-being. So it's about our heritage. So China, this is a significant step that China has taken.
Conservationists say that although combating poaching is critical, one of the bigger threats to elephants in the long term is habitat management. They urge African governments and China, through its support, to help reduce these threats. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Since 1987, the Gulu district in northern Uganda has faced the brunt of the war waged by Lord's Resistant Army rebels against the Ugandan government. Thousands of people, including men, women, and children, were abducted, killed, raped, or maimed. Others were forced to join the rebellion. One man has chosen to heal the unseen scars of that war using what he calls comfort dogs. Halima Althumani traveled to Gulu town and brings us the story.
11 years since the end of the civil war launched by the Lord's Resistance Army rebels against the Ugandan government, tens of thousands still struggle with post-traumatic stress disorder. Mental health practitioners estimate that 7 in 10 people in northern Uganda were traumatically affected by the war. At the age of 12, Francis Okello Loya, a community psychologist, now 29, was blinded by a bomb blast as he dug in their family garden. The bomb shrapnel entered deep into his left eyeball socket, leading to his blindness. In a boarding school for the blind, Okello found it difficult to ask people for help, especially during toilet visits at night. This was the birth of the Comfort Dog Project idea.
I had to navigate my way from the sleeping quarter to latrine, and that was not easy. And these dogs came to know that I needed help, and they began the practice of helping me from the sleeping quarters to the latrine. Being a person of visual impairment, you normally feel that you are going to burden people a lot.
While dogs are mainly used for hunting in Uganda and a few people warming up to owning dogs at home, especially for security, Okello went around collecting street dogs that are treated before being handed over to their guardians who get training in dog handling. Inspired by the school guard dogs in 2015, Okello started the Comfort Dog Project to help people in Gulu town, especially those suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, depression and anxiety. Phil Dakum, 35 years old, is one of the 29 beneficiaries of the Comfort Dog Project. She was abducted by the LRA in 1997, together with her 4 brothers, and taken to Sudan. One of her brothers tried to escape. And she says she got him and they started cutting him from the hands, legs, neck, and he died. Another brother was selected to go to the battlefront, and he was shot dead. She says 2 days later, her youngest brother contracted cholera and he too died. She says this all left her traumatized. She returned home and joined group therapy, and that's how she got her dog, Lock Oroma. 39-year-old Lucia Dot spent 5 years in the bush as a corporal. I was in combat and saw many people being killed, she says. I was destroyed. When I returned home, I experienced flashbacks, and any loud sound sounded like a bullet. When I learned that I could get a dog as a friend, I took on Sadiq and now spend a lot of time with Sadiq. I have dreams of our games during the day, and slowly, Sadiq replaced the bad memories from the war. The dogs find a home, and the guardians, life companions. It is the hope of these former child war victims that their own children don't have the same fate, but play and enjoy their childhood. Halima Athmani for VA News, Gulu.
That is it for us this evening on VOA Zimbabwe Today. I'm Chidonjere.
And I'm Kutsanai Mutetwa. We'll be back again tomorrow at 9:30 p.m. Zimbabwe time for the latest news and analysis in English. VOA Shana and Dabele broadcasts can be heard at 7 a.m., 2 p.m., and 7 p.m. Zimbabwe time.
Stay with us around the clock on Facebook at Studio 7, VOA Ndebele and VOA Shona, as well as our VOA website, www.studio7news.com.
We leave you now with music by Brenda Faso.